Today's readings bring up a lot of very rich themes, which we will return to often throughout the year, because the whole gospel is new wine, and it takes us a while to be transformed into new wineskins to be able to contain it all. Most of the time it spills out because we're still in our old ways. But anyway, today we're introduced to, again, this theme of the priesthood of Christ and the mysterious figure of Melchizedek. As I say, we'll come back to this. The letter to the Hebrews comes back to Melchizedek again and again. Just to give a brief overview of it, the Jews had a priesthood. They had an inherited priesthood from the line of, from the tribe of Levi. And that's where the priest came from, the tribe of Levi. Jesus wasn't from that tribe. He was from the tribe of Judah. And yet he was clearly fulfilling the role of a priest because he made sacrifice. So the Christians recognized, well, here's a priest, a high priest, who offers the greatest sacrifice, but he's not from the line of Levi. So what is this? And so they look back and they discover the priest in the Old Testament who was not from the tribe of Levi was Melchizedek. In fact, Melchizedek is a unique figure because he's both priest and king. Whereas in the rest of the Old Testament, kings were one category and priests were another category. Kings were anointed as kings. Priests were anointed as priests. But there were no priest kings. So the expectation of the Jews that the Messiah would be a great king, because he was going to be like a new David, was limited because they didn't expect him to also be a priest. And along comes Jesus, and the letter to the Hebrews is all about Jesus, all about a more profound understanding of who Jesus is. And so this section of the letter is to make it clear that, yes, he's a priest, he's a high priest, but he's not a priest in the old law. He's not a priest according to the old category. He's a priest according to an eternal category, and the forerunner of that kind of priest is Melchizedek. So we're talking about something different, something new, something that was that broke out of the expectations of the Jews. We'll come back to Melchizedek later this week, but let's focus here for a moment on this gospel passage where the people ask Jesus about fasting. Fasting is a standard religious practice in all religions, and the disciples of John the Baptist fasted like any good disciple. The disciples of the Pharisees fasted. The Pharisees fasted twice a week. So this is a pretty standard thing. That's no surprise. But the people notice that the disciples of Jesus don't fast. So they're not doing it according to the old way. They're not following the expected rule of religious people. And so they ask Jesus, why don't your disciples fast? The implication is you're not training them properly. You're not giving your disciples the right religious formation. Okay, a legitimate question. And Jesus, I don't know if this expression is common in the Philippines, but he throws them a curveball. he completely changes the subject, it seems like. It takes them off guard completely. He brings up this business about wedding guests. Now, fasting and weddings just don't go together. They're two different things. You don't fast at a wedding. When you're fasting, you're not at a wedding. When you're at a wedding, you're not fasting. They just don't go together. So Jesus, by bringing this up, it seems at first like he's completely changing the subject, but what he's trying to do is introduce a new way of seeing who he is. It's like understanding the priesthood in a new way. He's not a priest according to the tribe of Levi. He's according to the order of Melchizedek, which is a new thing, which you're not thinking about. As I was reflecting on this, I was thinking about children at in the evening. They see the sun set. Sun goes down, it gets dark. Well, if you were to ask a young child, well, where's the sun? They would say, well, the sun is down there someplace. And when are you going to see the sun again? Well, it'll have to come back. It'll have to come back up. It was over there in the west. It'll have to come up there. And then you have to say to the child, no, turn around and face exactly the other direction. And in the morning, you'll see the sun way over here in the east. That's something like what Jesus is doing. You're looking into the west. You're looking into the past. You're looking into what has settled. You're in a kind of darkness about the way to practice religion. And Jesus says, now turn around completely, face the east. And the sun will rise and you'll have a whole new day. Maybe that's a bad analogy, but you can see the idea is Jesus is really getting them to turn around by talking about weddings. Now, in the church, we have the practice of fasting, naturally be associated especially with the season of Lent, but fasting is part of every Friday, and in fact, it's just part of the Christian life. Voluntary self-denial is part of being a Christian. Jesus says it many times. But in the Christian life, there's also exuberant celebration because we have much reason for rejoicing. If you were to walk into a Trappist monastery and see people who wake up at 2:30 in the morning and who never eat meat and who practice very rigid ascetical disciplines, you might say, these people can never be happy. There's no joy in this place. But if you were to walk into the Basilica in Cebu yesterday, and you saw people dancing and colorful costumes and a beautiful church with just elaborate decorations, flowers, colors, you would say, these people never fast. These people obviously don't fast. They're obviously a rejoicing people. And you say, that's two different churches. No. They go together. They go together. Fasting and feasting go together. And I think this is part of the wisdom of the Christian faith, especially Catholicism, that they go together because Jesus is at the center of our faith, and Jesus fasted, and Jesus celebrated, and the presence of Jesus with us, which is our great cause for joy, also gives us incentive to fast in order to celebrate him. Yesterday was, of course, the Feast of Santo Niño. It's a very joyful feast, and I had a couple of Santo Niño masses, and I had forgotten this, that part of Santo Niño is not just honoring the image in the sanctuary, but people carry their own Santo Niños with them. A lot of people bring an image of Santo Niño to the church with them. And in the processions, it's not just to follow one image, but a lot of people are carrying Santo Niño. Some people have more than one. And in the parish church yesterday, there were five. There were five Santo Niños in the sanctuary. And as if to say, we're not just celebrating something that everybody has. This is also a personal experience, that Jesus is not just with us, Jesus is with me. And when people dance for joy, they dance because Jesus is with me. He's my Savior too. I think it's part of the devotion. And sometimes a lot of people asked me to bless their Santo Niño images yesterday. So, yes, because when we go home from the church, Jesus is still with us. He's in my house. He's in my bedroom or wherever I put my little statue. That's part of the joy of Christianity, that Jesus is with us. That the bridegroom is here. That we have a reason for celebration. You can't fast when the bridegroom is with you. And yet, part of following Jesus is strong self-denial, taking up the cross, deliberately denying yourself things that you could have as a discipline, as a form of of preparing for the union with the bridegroom. Again, maybe I'm not too good at thinking these things through, but I know a lot of married couples, and I know that marriage is a very difficult vocation. And the most successful marriages are those where both husband and wife practice a lot of self-denial. There's a lot of self-denial involved in a happy marriage. And you might go into a family and like going into a Trappist monastery and say, this family can never be happy because they don't do what they want and they're always giving in to each other and they practice disciplines to make the family orderly. This, they can never be happy. But if you actually know the life of the family, of the marriage, you say, well, no, they're very happy because they love. And love, which is the best way to live and the happiest way to live, requires a lot of death to self. So I'm rambling here, but no, I'm trying to reflect on the newness that Jesus has brought into the world. The new wine, it requires a fasting from old ways, a fasting from selfishness, a fasting from self-focus and pampering, so that we can rejoice in our union with the bridegroom. The happiest Christians are those who know how to deny themselves. Now, I don't know if on Santo Niño, if the devotions to Santo Niño also emphasize self-denial. I'm not that familiar with it. But it seems to me, if it's going to be authentic Christianity, it's going to be authentic discipleship of Jesus Christ, it can't only be dancing and joyful celebration. It can't only be that, because we can't celebrate all the time. It's impossible. We have to make space for the celebration. We have to deny ourselves, prepare for celebration. And that's what fasting represents. So I think this is what Jesus is trying to alert his listeners to, and us, that there are profound reasons not to fast. There are profound reasons for great, joyful, exuberant celebration. But there are also profound reasons to fast, and we do both in the church. The wisdom of the church is to have both Lent and Easter, to have both fasting and feasting at the right times, in the right order, so that we can grow more deeply in our relationship with the bridegroom, so that we can more fully contain and preserve the new wine of the gospel.